Author and New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik seems to be everywhere, maybe because I have his new book on my nightstand. But wait, why is Jimmy Kimmel talking about him at the Oscars? Something about the opening to the film Tar? Yes, that's Adam Gopnik playing himself, a critic, in the Oscar-nominated film Tar, listening as Cate Blanchett, playing the imperious conductor Lydia Tar, holds forth on her craft. But in his new book, Adam Gopnik moves from critic to participant, learning how to draw, bake bread, box, ballroom dance, understand magic, drive a car, he's a city boy, and, well, pee, because of a pretty serious personal medical challenge, an incredible story. More on that in a bit. The book is The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery, and Adam Gopnik joins us again. Adam, welcome back, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on which? My 5 minutes of stardom or my new book? I hope my new book more.
Your new book. The Real Work, it's a magician's phrase. Remind us.
Yes. When I was hanging out with magicians, I was startled because when magicians gather at 3 a.m. in a diner in Las Vegas after their performances, I heard them always using this phrase, the real work. Who's got the real work on that? Flosso's illusion. Who's got the real work on that? And I realized over time that what they meant by the real work was not who had invented the trick, nor who did it in the most technically spectacular way. No, what they meant was who had combined technical virtuosity with a kind of empathetic engagement with the audience that made the thing really work perfectly. And it was a kind of epiphany for me, because I think it's exactly what all of us seek in the vocations we practice and in the things we do. And we always recognize the real work when we see it.
Yeah. And you say you want to feel what mastery feels like outside your own field. And we must say you are a master, wordsmith, but you want to feel what others feel. And one can do that without being the master.
Yeah, well, I do think it's true that one of the ways that we remind ourselves what we went through to get good at something is to be bad at something for a while. And in all of these chapters, I'm really bad at what I'm trying to do. I'm a terrible draftsman. I'm the world's most nervous and incompetent motorist. And as a boxer, you can imagine the only way they'd ever put me into a fight is if they could find some other middle-aged Jewish writer who's 5'5" and has been sedentary for the past 50 years. But through the experience of understanding what it is to master these things, I get a sense of what it is. Because, you know, the truth is, it's always the same process. You learn a set of awkward, stumbling little steps, and then just through sheer perseverance, they become at least the illusion of a seamless sequence. And seeing the commonality of that is not only moving, at least for me, and funny, I hope, but it's also a reminder of how much the interiority of our experience matters. I get just as much satisfaction from throwing a jab and a cross as I do from writing a beautiful sentence. And in a way, it doesn't matter how well you do it in the exterior world. If you're doing it in a satisfactory way in your own interior, it becomes foundational and inspirational.
Well, let's take driving, for instance, though, where it does sort of matter how well you do it sure. In the exterior world. And it is hilarious. But what you're also doing in this book is giving incredible credit to people we don't often think of as masters, including someone who taught you how to drive. Now, when you're learning how to drive, you are not the New Yorker's Adam Gopnik. You are, as your instructor says, trying to become the noodle.
Exactly. My wonderful driving teacher, Arturo Leon, really inspired teacher. What he meant by become the noodle was find somehow in your body language at least the impersonation of someone who's actually relaxed driving a car. Because your performance as a driver is directed at the driving judge, the person who will or will not give you the license. And she's as likely to be impressed by your ease or your apparent ease in driving as your actual expertise in driving. The performance of a skill, in a sense, is as important as possession of a skill.
Yeah. Well, you go out of your way to say that your book is not a self-help book, and that there isn't a, here are five steps to learn this. As we read, though, we pick up tips, like when you decide to take drawing lessons. Now, you're like a lot of people. You can't draw. But you decide to do this with artist Jacob Collins, who sounds like a wonderful realist artist with a studio in New York. Sounds so wonderful. Yeah. Students really do, you know, sit and try to draw a nude figure. But I learned from you, hold the pencil in an underhanded way and make brushing strokes instead of gripping it the way we do. Don't try to paint what you think a chest looks like. Let's say when you're painting a nude, paint something that you see in the chest. Right. Here, you've written what your teacher tells you. Find something in the chest to draw. Find a dog, the outline of some small African nation. Draw that.
Exactly. The key to learning how to draw naked people or human faces is not to just stare at what you're looking at and then try and draw what you see. No one can do that. What you do is you learn, exactly as you said, you learn these little schema, you learn these little subroutines. One of them was finding the shape of an African nation or the profile of a snooty butler in the play of light on flesh. Another one was he had weeks doing what he called tilts in time, just looking at faces and seeing, imagining that they were clock faces, human faces were clock faces, and seeing how the features, the smile or the frown or the eyebrows on it, what time they would be if they were on a clock, 10 past 2, quarter to 3, and so on. And you just spend weeks making tilts in time. And once again, it's exactly those stumbling steps you learn to make that, if you persevere, become eventually the seamless illusion of an actual face.
You bake with your mom, who, in addition to being some sort of a Nobel Prize winner, she's a brilliant woman, is a baker, an extraordinary baker. And what I love about that passage is you remind us of the mastery in people that we don't acknowledge.
So much of what's been traditionally banished or seconded as women's work is, in fact, incredibly powerful forms of mastery and accomplishment that we don't always see as such. You know, my mother is a scientist and a professor, but she also was a fantastic baker for a family of six children. And I went north back to my parents' place in Ontario to pay homage and learn more humbly than I would have done as an adolescent. One of my favorite things that I learned, because I became concerned as my mother got older, as she is now, about what would happen to her sourdough starter. As I'm sure you know, they call the sourdough starter the mother. And it turns out that the microbes on the baker's hands remain in the sourdough starter even after the baker is gone, can persist for 100 years. So it's the schmutz on your mother's hands that will live forever. What will remain of us is schmutz.
Look, we have come to the moment in the book, which, you know, is one of the most personal things, obviously, you've written about, which is, you know, a struggle that you had with something that's called shy bladder syndrome. A lot of people have it. And that brings us to, you know, an inability to pee. And the important thing here is, again, the master that you meet, a social worker who had also problems with this ailment. And he took you to bathrooms, fascinating bathrooms around Manhattan. You'd bike ride around, work on the challenge of mastering this thing that you needed to master. That's incredible.
Well, as you can imagine, that was the hardest chapter to write because, of course, it's based on a foundation of embarrassment, things we don't want to talk about. But I felt strongly two things. One is that any work of art or writing that you attempt that doesn't have something in it that makes you say, I'll never get away with this, is probably not going to ever really ripen. And the other thing is that that whole chapter is about disassembling the condition that I suffer from and have worked on, is actually has a technical name, periuresis. And there's an international periuresis association devoted to helping people with the affliction. But it's something you have constructed over time, over decades. And the work you have to do when you're doing cognitive therapy is to unconstruct it, to deconstruct it. And so just in the same way we build our masteries out of all those stumbling little steps that turn into something positive, we have to undo our anxieties and our phobias through exactly the same sequence of small steps, gradual ascent up what they call the exposure hierarchy from different bathrooms, different conditions, stalls and urinals and so on. It's comic. It's absurd in some ways, but it's absolutely essential. And if you suffer from this condition, it severely limits your capacity to move freely in the world. And I wanted that chapter to be in the book because mastery isn't always just the positive, sunny side of accomplishment. It's also the painful, cloudy side of taking apart a structure, a prison that we've made for ourselves that prevents us from living a completely fulfilled life.
It also reminds us, well, two things. One, I want to take a tour of great bathrooms in Manhattan. But two, all of the things that you did required you to say, well, I might be a little humble here. I might be a little vulnerable here, but that's okay.
Yeah, you know, maybe that's part of maturing. Maybe that's part of entering what I like to think of as middle age. But certainly, I think that that's something that we've all known. And if there's a message in the book, exactly as you said, I say at one point in the book, this is a self-help book that won't help. It won't give you five recipes for accomplishing things. But it may help you understand what it is to be a self, how we construct ourselves out of all the things we emulate and attempt to master. And part of that is exactly looking comic, looking inept, looking foolish, and finding that in the business of looking foolish, we eventually emancipate ourselves from our fears. For me, that was the central lesson. It was humbling in lots of ways. I'm not a terribly humble person, as my children will be the first to tell you. But choosing to attempt things, which I knew I would never be very good at, was probably more instructive than anything I've ever done.
New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik, and he's also a lyricist, a composer, and now a boxer and a baker and all sorts of things. His book is The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. Adam, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure talking to you.